Once upon a time, flying drones were seen as not much more than toys and met with serious skepticism from military planners.
But in the last decade, drones led by the Predator drones have become a huge part of the American military efforts and of the nation's counterterrorism program.
Our next guest tells the story of the drones' rise to prominence. Richard Whittle is a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He's covered the military for 3 decades, and he's the author of the new book, Predator, The Secret Origins of the Drone Revolution. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the history, we've been hearing in the news today drones being used against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. How big a part of our military and counterterrorism efforts are drones today?
Well, I don't have the exact numbers of how many they're using over there, of course, but you can bet that they're playing an important role because, you know, the important thing that these drones do these days, and the Predator was the first, is that they can stay in the air for anywhere from 24 to 40 hours. And that provides an eye in the sky that allows the military to seek out targets. And that's going to be more and more important now after these initial airstrikes by manned aircraft have forced the ISIS fighters to seek cover among the civilian population. You know, they'll be the U.S. military now has 139 Predators, armed Predators, and 165 armed Reapers, which is a larger derivative of the Predator that carries a heavier weapons load. My book tells the story of how this all started, you know, and I tell the story of how when the day after 9/11, the U.S. Air Force had 3 armed Predators. They had barely gotten ready. They had been preparing to try to send them to assassinate Osama bin Laden. And they got over to Uzbekistan, where they were going to fly from, and one crashed before the war began. So we've gone from 2 in the initial weeks on the day that the war in Afghanistan began, October 7, 2001, to quite a large fleet now. And they play a key role in directing other aircraft to targets. They can shine laser designators on targets to guide bombs to them, and they can fire missiles, and the Reaper can drop bombs itself.
Let's go back even a little further in the history of the drone. What were the first ancestors of today's drones like?
Well, you know, Rob, the military has been trying to use unmanned aircraft since World War I. They built little biplanes about the size of a go-kart, and we're planned to put explosives in the nose, and they were called aerial torpedoes. Between the wars, the actor Reginald Denny out in Hollywood developed target drones to train anti-aircraft gunners. And during the Vietnam War, the military had jet-powered drones. They were called Firebees and Fireflies and Lightning Bugs. And they carried still photo cameras for the most part. Some were armed. But they didn't work very well. They only flew about 4 missions on average before they crashed or were shot down. The Predator came along, and I tell the story of the Predator in this book from its invention in a former Israeli aeronautical engineer's Los Angeles garage, to its arming by the Air Force, to its use on behalf of the CIA and the military in Afghanistan. And the Predator changed everything, partly because of the genius of this Israeli inventor, Abraham Karam.
Tell us his story. He was born in Baghdad and grew up in Israel.
Right. He was born in Baghdad in 1937. His family moved to Israel, and he was raised there in that sort of socialist culture that prevailed in Israel in the late 1940s and early 1950s in its early days. And he was very precocious. He became a top aeronautical engineer early in life. In his 20s, he was in the Israeli Air Force. By the time he was in his early 30s, he was the director of preliminary design, essentially the director of innovation for Israel Aircraft Industries, the country's most important aerospace company. And then he was seized with the idea during the Yom Kippur War. He was asked to design a drone as a decoy to fool Egyptian and Syrian air defenses, and he was seized with the idea of designing more unmanned aircraft. He left his job after doing that project. He emigrated to the United States, and, you know, like all great American inventors, went to work in his garage. And he came up with a configuration for a drone that he called the Albatross, because, you know, the albatross is a bird that soars better than almost any in nature. And among the things Abe Karam did in Israel as a kid was to make these models called free flight models that are designed to be thrown or towed into the air like a kite and then soar. So he knew how to make a plane stay in the air a long time, and that's what he set out to do, and that changed the whole nature of drones once Abe Karam came up with the configuration, which we still see today in the shape and form of the Predator and the Reaper.
When these first modern drones, what ended up being the ones that are used today, were pitched to the U.S. military, was there reluctance? Was there skepticism?
Absolutely. You know, there was no natural home for drones in the military. In the old days, the Air Force, you know, is run by pilots, and they weren't much interested in aircraft that didn't have one of them in it. And, you know, the Army mainly flies helicopters, so they weren't all that interested in the kind of drone that Abe Karam was coming up with. And Navy captains, you know, never liked having aircraft that have gas in them but no pilot coming in to land on their ships. You know, it's a pretty dangerous operation. And so there was resistance. And in fact, Abe Karam, you know, went bankrupt trying to sell his Endurance Unmanned Aerial Vehicle, as it's technically called, to the military. Now, two brothers from Denver, Neil and Lyndon Blue, came along. They were incredibly wealthy. They had bought a company from Chevron and renamed it General Atomics, and they were interested in getting into the drone business, and they bought Abe Karam's intellectual property and hired him and his team in 1991. They bought his intellectual property for $1.85 million, and their company has been making many multiples of that ever since, almost ever since, by selling Predators and Reapers and other derivatives to the military.
And just a few years later, they got tested on battlefields as reconnaissance drones, right, in the war in the Balkans?
Exactly, Rob. At first, the Predator was just an eye in the sky. And this is, you know, one of the things that I get into in the book and that I found fascinating about the Predator myself is it was kind of like the first personal computers, you know, the old boxy IBM thing that sat on your desk and wasn't connected to anybody else's, right? So it was a technology that was interesting to a lot of people. But at first, most people didn't really know what they could do with it that was all that special. Innovators came along. They came up with new software, new hardware, new communications architectures that turned the personal computer from a novelty into a necessity. And that's exactly what happened with the Predator. The military bought it and started buying it in 1994 as a test, actually, and it was inspired by the need to find Serb artillery that was bombarding Sarajevo in that terrible war in Bosnia back then. They used it as an eye in the sky, but there was an incredible character, a techno-scientist, whose real name I wasn't permitted to use in the book, but who I call Werner, who came up with innovations that allowed the Predator's video to be streamed directly into the Pentagon and to military command centers elsewhere. He came up with a way for the Predator to be controlled from Germany as it flew over Afghanistan looking for Osama bin Laden in the year 2000. And then he came up with a way for the Predator to be controlled from the United States, specifically from the parking lot of the CIA headquarters building.
And we'll pick up the story from there after the news as we talk to Richard Whittle talking about the rise of drones, Predator drones. His new book is Predator, The Secret Origins of the Drone Revolution.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the rise of drone technology and how drones are used today? Do you think they should be used for counterterrorism strikes or in wars? And do you think the U.S. is overusing drones? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with Richard Whittle. He's the author of Predator, The Secret Origins of the Drone Revolution.
He tells the story of the invention of modern drones and how they came to be so widely used in the military and counterterrorism here in the United States. You can join in with your questions and your thoughts at 800-642-1234. And do you have thoughts on how much we use drones? Do you think we overuse them, or are they a good substitute for sending in piloted vehicles, sending in troops in some cases? 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Richard, before the news, you were telling us some of the big innovations, including being able to control drones from anywhere on the planet. Another huge one that made a big difference in the missions they're used for, attaching missiles, specifically Hellfire missiles, to them. How did that come about?
Right, Robin. I was fascinated to learn, you know, before I started the book, I had heard that, well, the CIA armed the Predator. I found actually the Air Force started arming the Predator in May of 2000. And by coincidence, almost, Richard Clark at the National Security Council, who was the chief counterterrorism advisor to President Clinton, and a man named Charlie Allen in the CIA, had come to the conclusion that the United States needed to kill Osama bin Laden before al-Qaeda killed more Americans, as they had done in bombing our embassies in 1998 in Kenya and Tanzania, and as they did again in October 2000, when they bombed the destroyer USS Cole. So an Air Force general suggested to them, they didn't know where Osama bin Laden was precisely, how to target him, and the Air Force suggested, well, send a Predator to look for him. So this first innovation we were talking about, they decided they had to put the ground control station at Ramstein Air Base in Germany, because it takes, you know, the ground control station is roughly the size of a freight container. There are a couple of satellite Earth terminals that are needed. And usually they would fly within 500 miles of where the Predator was going to be, but you couldn't do that from the countries surrounding Afghanistan. So that was an innovation. And I interviewed the pilot who was at the controls, Captain Scott Swanson, when they found Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. At the time, the Predator was not armed, but the Air Force had a project going to do that. Finding Osama bin Laden with the Predator made Richard Clark get excited about that project to arm the Predator. And over the next year, in the spring and summer of 2001, an Air Force unit, a very special organization called Big Safari, armed the Predator. And I go into some detail in the book about how they went about that, preparing it for what they thought was going to be a mission to kill Osama bin Laden. Well, they decided they couldn't leave the ground control station in Germany if they were going to pull the trigger on a missile strike from there. So Big Safari, this techno-scientist I mentioned earlier, came up with a way to control the drone from a ground control station parked on the CIA campus in Langley, Virginia, and painted to look like a freight container with a mobile home next to it where the Air Force command center was. And that's how we got to the stage today where we have a communications architecture that allows the Air Force to fly Predators and Reapers on around the globe, basically from bases in the United States.
We'll go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Rick on the line in Grafton. Rick, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing? Great subject. Being former military, I personally think that drones save a lot of lives. They gather much more intelligence than you could ever get any other way. And with the advances in facial recognition and other that the computers are doing, it's going to be able to do a lot more surgical kill and save a lot of innocent lives. But, you know, that's my opinion.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Richard, is that something you heard from a lot of people
in
the military?
Yeah, I think Rick makes a good point. You know, there is a lot of concern about so-called collateral damage, innocent people being killed in drone strikes. The weapons are actually much more discriminating than what is used in other forms of airstrikes. You know, the average fighter plane is dropping a 500-pound bomb. That's a huge explosion. The Hellfire missile that the Predator carries has a 20-pound warhead, and it's laser guided. It should hit. I mean, nothing's perfect, but it should hit within a couple of feet of where that laser is pointed. And as Rick suggested, the value of the Predator of these drones is actually more in what the military calls intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, because they can stay overhead far longer than a manned aircraft can, pointing their cameras at the ground, largely unseen, and they can and their video streams directly back to command centers. And thanks to this organization I've mentioned before, Big Safari, soldiers on the ground can carry a Predator screen on a device called a rover. So it's really been a huge change in the way the military wages war. And I tell the, if I can just mention one more thing, I tell the story in the book of how the Predator saved lives in a famous battle in Afghanistan called Robert's Ridge, partly by being able to tell Army Rangers who were on top of the mountain where the enemy was.
Now, one of the most controversial uses of drones is in the realm of targeted killings. How much back and forth was there over targeting members of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, first of all, and since the period you write about, of course, use in other countries around the world as well?
Right. You know, it was very interesting to me in doing the book to learn in interviewing senior CIA people from those days that there was a lot of angst among at Langley about the whole idea of the CIA controlling a military weapon and using it in a way that could lead to a headline like CIA uses armed drone to assassinate Islamic militant. You know, before 9/11, there was a whole different atmosphere. As you know, the CIA was involved in huge scandals in the 1970s because of assassination plots, and there was actually an executive order banning assassination by the CIA or other U.S. government people. So prior to 9/11, in fact, the Bush administration only took up the whole issue of whether to send the armed Predator after Osama bin Laden on September 4th, 2001. And at that meeting, the CIA director, George Tenet, was unwilling to say that he would take responsibility for pulling the trigger. And the military didn't want to go after Osama bin Laden with an armed drone that only had a 20-pound warhead on it. They wanted to send B-52 bombers if they were going to do anything. So there was a whole different attitude. After 9/11, the gloves came off. And, of course, now a lot of people think that the CIA is basically addicted to using drone strikes to go after terrorists.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Mark on the line in Mineral Point. Mark, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. I want to try to introduce a different perspective on this. I think what we're hearing so far is a lot of cheerleading for technology that is it's really responsible for all kinds of atrocities against innocent people. And all the talk about Osama bin Laden is a big red herring, because mainly what has been done with these drones is to directly or indirectly kill tons of innocent civilians. With the propaganda that all these people being killed are all terrorists. And the word terrorist is also a red herring. That's my opinion.
Mark, thanks for the call. There have been cases of innocent civilians being hit. Weddings, I think, in Pakistan in drone attacks, I think, Richard.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, there certainly have been mistakes. In fact, I quote a general in my book as saying, look, in the early days, you know, any tall man was somebody that we might want to go after, and mistakes were made. You know, the point that I would make, I'm not cheerleading for the technology. I'm telling the story of how we got here. I think that the drones raise several issues that we as a society need to figure out how to cope with. One is these drone strikes. You know, we don't, the executive branch essentially runs that program, more or less, without much transparency. Another, you know, drones are coming into the civilian airspace now, and we need to figure out, the FAA is working, the Federal Aviation Administration is working very hard to figure out, how to regulate them so that our skies remain safe, and we have to maintain our privacy. The Center for American Progress is a respected think tank in Washington. No one has exact figures on how many civilians have been, innocent civilians have been killed in drone strikes, but the Center for American Progress tracks them as best they can from media reports, and they actually find that the number of civilian casualties has declined significantly over the past few years. I think that's true because I think that the people who work on the weaponry try their best not to kill civilians. That's not their aim, and it doesn't do them any good when that happens. But, you know, it's not a robotic killer aircraft. You know, it's not an aircraft that's picking its own targets, and the people who are actually flying it with the controls aren't picking the targets exactly. It depends on intelligence from the ground, and if the intelligence is bad, they may in fact fire missiles and kill the wrong people.
Is there concern over blowback from the use of drone strikes around the world in terms of drones as a symbol for American power, for good or ill, and maybe for terrorist recruiters who say, look, Americans are operating drones in our airspace. We need to fight back however we can.
Right. That's absolutely true. And you can imagine how you would feel if you were living, if you thought that some aircraft with no one in it was flying over your neighborhood and might launch a missile into your neighbor's house or into yours. You can understand how fearful that would make you feel. I think that there are even people at the CIA, former senior officials who I was able to interview, worry that the government has become too dependent on using that technology. But, you know, there are two aspects to this, Rob. I mean, one is the drone strikes that have been controlled by the CIA. Another is the use as a military technology, as a weapon to help commanders see the battlefield. And so you have to realize that the drone strikes is actually a relatively small sliver of the uses for this kind of technology.
We'll leave it there for now. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Richard Whittle. He's a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. His new book is Predator, The Secret Origins of the Drone Revolution.